Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time, and perhaps that's the only way to survive what he's witnessed. One moment, he's a successful optometrist in 1960s Ilium, New York, examining a patient's eyes. The next, he's a terrified prisoner of war stumbling through the snow in a woman's coat and frozen boots. This isn't a literary device or a clever metaphor. For Billy, time has become a scrambled film reel, and he's trapped watching his life play out of sequence, unable to control which scene comes next. What sounds like science fiction is actually the most honest depiction of trauma ever written, because this is what war does. It shatters your relationship with time itself, making the past as vivid and immediate as the present, collapsing decades into a single, endless moment of horror that refuses to stay buried. On Trelfamador, Billy learns a radical truth. All moments exist simultaneously and eternally. Picture time not as a flowing river, but as a mountain range where every peak, birth, death, joy, suffering, exists at once. The Trelfamadorians, resembling plumber's friends with a single green eye, see all of time the way we scan a landscape. To them, death is merely being in bad condition in that particular moment, while existing perfectly well in countless others. When Billy asks why they can't prevent their planet's destruction, they respond with eerie calm. The moment is structured that way. This philosophy offers strange comfort. Dresden happened, is happening, will always be happening, but so are all the good moments. Ignore the awful times, they advise, and concentrate on the good ones. Yet the novel never quite answers, are the Trelfamadorians real, or Billy's psychological defense mechanism against unbearable memories? His daughter Barbara thinks it's brain damage from the plane crash, but perhaps it doesn't matter. Whether alien philosophy or human coping strategy, this fourth-dimensional perspective allows Billy to endure the unendurable. Mary O'Hare erupts when she learns about Billy's book project. She refuses to let him glorify men with medals and heroism. You were just babies, she insists. The novel's subtitle, The Children's Crusade, references the 1213 expedition when monks sold 30,000 children into slavery under the guise of holy war. Billy is tall, gangly, weak, looking like a filthy flamingo in his mismatched uniform. His companion, Roland Weary, is only 18. Mean-spirited and violent because he's terrified. Even the English colonel who first sees the American prisoners is shocked. My God, it's the Children's Crusade. These aren't warriors making calculated sacrifices. They're confused, frightened children thrust into circumstances beyond their comprehension, forced to participate in adult atrocities they never chose. The Germans guarding them, themselves just boys, middle-aged men, and wounded veterans, laugh with relief upon seeing the ridiculous American prisoners, having expected fearsome enemy soldiers. War doesn't discriminate between the prepared and unprepared, the willing and unwilling. It simply consumes children and calls it necessary. Billy leads American prisoners through Dresden in a toga-like curtain and silver boots from a Cinderella production, absurd and tragic simultaneously. This is Vonnegut's genius, making you laugh at the precise moment you should be crying, creating cognitive dissonance that forces deeper thought. The novel's most famous phrase, so it goes, appears after every death, from 135,000 Dresden civilians to Billy's wife Valencia to a champagne bottle. The casual repetition should numb us, but does the opposite. Each instance makes death more shocking. When camp soap was made from the fat of rendered Jews and gypsies, the matter-of-fact delivery amplifies the horror. Even Edgar Darby's heroic stand against Nazi propaganda, the moment that should be the novel's triumphant climax, is undercut by our knowledge he'll be executed days later for stealing a teapot. His genuine belief in American values means nothing against war's arbitrary cruelty. The juxtaposition is darkly funny and profoundly sad, exposing the emptiness of patriotic rhetoric when actual lives are at stake. Dresden was the loveliest city most Americans had ever seen. Intricate, voluptuous, enchanted, like a Sunday school picture of heaven. Unlike other German cities, it hadn't suffered so much as a cracked window pane. Life continued normally in this architectural jewel, untouched by war's destruction. Then came February 13, 15, 1945. After emerging from their meat locker shelter, Billy found a transformed landscape. Dresden was like the moon now, nothing but minerals. Buildings collapsed into graceful curves of rubble. The stones were hot. Everybody else in the neighborhood was dead. 135,000 civilians, more than died in Hiroshima's initial blast, incinerated in a firestorm that turned a living city into a lunar wasteland overnight. Yet decades later, historian Bertram Copeland Rumford refuses to believe Billy was there. He consults books justifying the bombing as militarily necessary, unable to acknowledge this atrocity complicates America's moral narrative. Dresden has been effectively erased from public consciousness. History, it turns out, is written by the victors, and even democracies commit massacres during wartime. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Billy keeps this prayer in his office, but his interpretation slides toward total resignation. If all moments are fixed, why attempt change? When Billy asks why the Traufamadorians can't prevent their planet's destruction, they explain, "He has always pressed it, and he always will." Their fatalism mirrors Billy's passivity, yet the novel contradicts this philosophy. Vonnegut struggled 23 years to write about Dresden, comparing anti-war books to anti-glacier books, futile gestures against unstoppable forces. But he wrote it anyway. Edgar Derby's stand against Nazi propaganda, though futile, represents moral choice. The narrator's promise never to participate in massacres suggests we can refuse to perpetuate violence. The wisdom lies in recognizing what we can and cannot change. We cannot change the past, but we can change how we remember it. We cannot prevent all wars, but we can refuse to glorify them or hide their costs. The war ends. Billy and the other prisoners wake to find their door unlocked. They wander onto a quiet street with leafing trees. A bird asks Billy, "Pooty wheat?" This nonsensical chirp represents the only honest response to massacre, not explanation, not justification, but bewildered questioning. What words could possibly capture such horror? Throughout the novel, language fails repeatedly. Billy's So It Goes can't express appropriate grief. The Traufamadorian books are brief, urgent messages, forming a clump of symbols when seen all at once, suggesting linear narrative itself is inadequate. Even the subtitle, A Duty Dance with Death, uses metaphor because direct statement fails. By ending with the bird's question, Vonnegut acknowledges his own project's limits. This novel doesn't offer answers. It bears witness, asking unanswerable questions that force us to confront uncomfortable truths. Maybe the bird's chirp in the silence following destruction is the most honest thing we can offer. Some experiences shatter language itself, leaving us with nothing but bewildered questions and the courage to keep asking them, even when we know no answer will come.